It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
In the age of Donald Trump, the blue state of Maryland finds itself with a popular Republican governor. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Governor Larry Hogan has had an approval rating of above 70%. And in last year's presidential election, he kept his distance from then presidential candidate Donald Trump. The unemployment rate in the state is just above 4%, and Hogan has made rural counties like those in the Eastern Shore a top priority. Kathleen Matthews is the new chair of the Maryland Democratic Party. She did make a congressional bid, which lost to Representative Jamie Raskin. So how will she turn around the Democratic prospects, especially here on the Eastern Shore? We have Kathleen with us in the studio this morning. Welcome to the program.
Great. Thanks very much, Don. It's great to be on Delmarva Public Radio.
So, well, let me ask you this. So how are you going to turn around the state? Particularly, let's focus on the governorship for just a moment. Governor Hogan had above 70%. It's now, I think, down to about 65%, something like that is what I saw in terms of public opinion. Still a popular governor. Not as contentious, for instance, as Bob Ehrlich was, the other Republican governor before him. How do you confront that popularity? He seems very low-key, doesn't seem to have offended anybody.
I think 2017 and 2018 are very different years than the years we were looking at under the Ehrlich administration. There's a tremendous energy in the Democratic Party right now, really coming out of the 2018 election. And I also think that Democrats have learned some lessons from 2014 and 2016. And I think that they're going to be focusing on those pocketbook issues, putting more money in people's pockets. And that's really what I think the lesson of those election years were for us, that we've got to talk to people on those basic issues that really affect them personally. Jobs, good wages, benefits that allow you to do your job well. Public schools that are going to level the playing field and give everybody the opportunity, and the environment, which is so important here on the Lower Shore, because, you know, this is an area where tourism is the result of our beautiful coastline along the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic coastline. And we've got to preserve that and the planet and the environment of this area if we hope to have economic growth in the future. And these are the issues that Democrats are already talking about in the summer of 2017 as they gear up for not only the gubernatorial race, but opportunities to take mayoral seats, county council seats, legislative seats from Republican to Democrat.
Well, as a matter of fact, let's just look back for just a moment. That race some years back with Lieutenant Governor running against Hogan. What do you think happened? Because, as a matter of fact, when I was talking to some Democrats here, and one of the observations was, first, it seemed like there was a three-county approach, and that second, I was talking to, as a matter of fact, a prominent Democrat who ultimately lost a seat, who said, in essence, the problem with the Anthony Brown campaign was he didn't pay enough attention to places like the Shore, so that while he might not win on the Shore, he had that buffer. So that's sort of the portrait of what I had, and he's coming away from that election. How is next time going to be different?
In 2018, we are running a 24-county strategy. This means Baltimore City and the 23 counties around Maryland. And since I've been party chair, I've been traveling all over this state. This week, I'm in four of the counties, Wacomico, Worcester, Dorchester, Somerset. I'm talking to Democratic clubs, Democratic activists, Democratic central committees, and regular voters at the Taws Clam Bake. And this is the kind of strategy we know that will allow us to win in 2018, that we have to focus not just on those dense Democratic districts that Democrats have always focused on, Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Howard County, Prince George's, Montgomery County, but we've got to go to Western Maryland. And I've been spending a lot of time in Western Maryland, and they are activated in Western Maryland, Southern Maryland, and now here on the Eastern Shore. And this is really exciting to be back over here right now and to really be talking to people. This week we did a town hall. We went to the Evolution Brewery, a great example of the new growth, economic growth and enterprise that you see in Salisbury. And we had folks that are going to be competing against Republicans in races where Democrats haven't competed in the past. And I think it all comes back to the issues that we share in common. And these are Democrats care about these issues, Independents care about these issues. Republicans care about these issues. And that is, how am I going to do better in the future? And I think for Anthony Brown, you know, people like change. And there was 8 years of Democratic governorship. And oftentimes people say, let's try something new. But I think the important thing is we haven't seen economic growth under Governor Larry Hogan. We did a study at the Maryland Democratic Party looking at the independent data analysis. And we found that under his governorship, Marylanders have actually lost wages, that the average Marylander is making 60 cents less an hour under Governor Hogan. Whereas in Virginia, they're making $1.70 more an hour. And across the country, they're making 90 cents more an hour. So people are losing money in their pocket. And these are the issues that Democrats are talking about, that we think we have a better pathway towards improving wages, creating these new jobs through enterprise and growth, and also taking care of those basic things that are so important, like health care. This is a real animating issue right now. At our town hall last night, we had people show up saying, I'm one of those people, one of those 300,000 people in Maryland who had my health care taken care of as a result of the Affordable Care Act, because I was part of that Medicaid expansion. And if the Republicans have their way in Washington, I'm going to lose my health care and I'm going to go under. We also had somebody last night show up who is a home health care worker, and she's seen her pay under the current governor go down. She's making less money. And she said, I can't afford my car payments now because of that. And there she was with Democratic Senator Jim Mathias, showing him the paperwork and the frustration she's had working with this government in Annapolis to try to find out what happened to those wages. Why is she making less money? These are the pocketbook issues we're going to be focusing on.
Because the question I have really is that there is no, at least that I could discern, no dramatic issue. I mean, it's people are going along. Maybe they're doing okay, maybe not doing so much. They certainly see Larry Hogan distancing himself from the efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. On the one hand, he obviously says it's terrible. We got to do something about it. On the other hand, he was very clear about rejecting, for instance, the Senate version, which collapsed this week. There doesn't seem an issue that, say, would drive you to say, well, I want to break out of what we have right now. I mean, the arguments may be good, but those are arguments that are sitting in this studio, not necessarily awareness out in the electorate.
I think Larry Hogan is a great politician, and he knows how to dodge an issue. And we say he's been missing in action on a lot of these things. Where was he when, as a Republican governor, he could have been influential in opposing this Republican plan to repeal the Affordable Care Act? We saw other Republican governors across the country stand up against this plan. And I think as a result of them standing up, that's why we see this plan going down the tubes. Now, we have to still fight to keep affordable care and actually make that plan better, which is what Democrats are talking about. Now, Democrats, our representatives in Washington, are saying, now let's focus on improving the Affordable Care Act and make it not only affordable, but also even more broadly distributed. And so where was Larry Hogan when he could have stood up and had influence with this White House and with this Congress? Similarly, on climate change, as we have President Trump actually denying climate change, pulling out of this big global Paris climate change accord. Well, that's an issue right here on the lower shore with 3,000 miles of coastline here. We've got to protect our coastline. Otherwise, we're going to lose jobs and homes and businesses. And where was he in terms of standing up for that? And on the renewable energy portfolio, where the Democrats in Annapolis actually were able to override his veto on a renewable energy portfolio that is really important because it will create green jobs, new jobs of the future here in places like the Delmarva Peninsula. Where was Larry Hogan on that? We just say he's been missing in action on these things. On public education, when he could be advocating for investment, an investment that we know pays off, you know, he's meeting with Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, who wants to privatize our schools. You know, where is he standing for, you know, our public education? I think up and down the board, whether it's jobs, the lost wages we're seeing in Maryland, lack of support for public education, lack of support for health care, this is a governor who's been missing in action. And I think as we start talking about those things and pointing those out, and that's why we're starting our campaign in 2017, not the summer of 2018. We're starting it a year early, because we want to have those conversations with voters. We want to listen to voters and learn from them.
How big of a role is Donald Trump going to play in 2018 as far as the state is concerned?
Donald Trump lost the state of Maryland. Hillary Clinton got 61% of the vote. But in places like the Delmarva Peninsula, Donald Trump did really well. And that's because he made promises that people believed in. He promised that he was going to protect their health care. He promised that he was going to make America great again and create new jobs. But this is a president that has been so distracted by his tweeting, by the Russian investigation, and is basically, you know, an amateur who's not been able to deliver on the promise that people believed in. And I think that, you know, we will see people say, I'm disappointed in Donald Trump. I really believed he was going to change things for me.
But if you drive around the peninsula, lots of Trump signs. I mean, not just from the election, but they still are out there. I talked to a number of people. I just did a piece the other day in Ocean City where I talked to a number of people. And one of the things I asked about, because it was July 4th, said, well, what do you think about Donald Trump? And there were many people who said, I think he's doing a good job. Maybe I don't like the tweeting, but, you know, and they laugh a little, but they like him. How do you persuade voters here, which seems like natural Trump country, to turn to the Democratic side of this?
I think as we get closer to 2020, and I think 2018 will be even more of an indicator than 2017 is, I think that disappointment is going to grow. I mean, already we're seeing President Trump's approval ratings go down because he's not delivering. He said he was going to have quick fixes. He was going to build bridges. He was going to build dams. He was going to do all this infrastructure spending. And he's getting nothing done. And I think that as people continue to see lost wages, and it really affects them personally as they continue to see efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is giving them health care now, they're going to start to see this was empty promises from Donald Trump. And I think that those are the things that are going to make a big difference.
Let me ask you about in terms of Governor Hogan. You know, the governor's spent a lot of time here on the Eastern Shore. As a matter of fact, I've seen him more often than, for instance, I did say, for instance, Martin O'Malley, the last Democrat to occupy the governor's office. And, you know, he came by and he says, look, he says he's invested $1 million, for instance, in the Salisbury downtown area for mainstream revitalization. Talks about $370 million for lower shore projects, including 11 bridges along the Salisbury bypass. There's a feel, I will tell you, that suddenly somebody's paying attention on the Eastern Shore. Now, the interesting part of this is, to reach back to previous elections, in the past, we had Norm Conway, who was a House delegate who sat on the Appropriations Committee, and he did take care of a lot of the things that needed to be on the Eastern Shore. He, as we know, of course, was defeated. And now when Eastern Shore folks look, they say, oh, but I've got a governor who's paying attention. How do you respond to the idea that, I mean, even Mayor Jake Day is standing there with the governor, and it's certainly something to be expected because, after all, the governor's bringing home some bacon for here. What do you say to people? Say, hey, I'm doing okay. I don't know about the rest of you guys.
I think we have a governor who's a great politician, and he knows how to go and pay attention to where his base is. But I would argue, let's take a look at Senator Jim Mathias, who's been a representative for this area for a long time, for Worcester, Wicomico, and Somerset counties. And what has he been doing? Well, he, you know, voted for that renewable energy portfolio that will bring jobs to Maryland and will protect this Eastern Shore area. So, you know, we are really lucky to have someone like Senator Jim Mathias here. I'd say Mayor Jake Day, under his watch and previously under Jim Ireton, both Democratic mayors, that's where you saw the revitalization of Salisbury. And, you know, we have a governor who likes to take credit for all of these things. But I would ask him, why are wages lower under his term if he talks this good game about economic growth in our area? Why isn't he there arguing for those basics like health care? Why did he veto this earned sick leave bill? You know, people who work hard deserve to be able to stay home when they're sick so they can get better. And Senator Jim Mathias, you know, worked on that for 5 years to make sure that he had all that input from business, to make sure it was going to be a good bill for business, but also a good bill for Marylanders. And where was Governor Hogan? He had a plan that would have hardly covered anybody in his proposal for a alternative health care bill or sick leave bill. So, you know, I think that what Democrats have learned is that we can't go with the quick slogans. We can't just campaign in the final days of the election and count on our 2-to-1 majority in terms of voter registration. We've got a campaign day in and day out, quietly, in conversations, listening to people, and connecting with people on that basis. And I think that's the lesson we've learned, and we think that that's the politics that will work in the future.
Well, speaking of State Senator Jim Mathias, he's one of the last Democrats standing. I mean, there were a number of Democrats when I got here.
That's why we're over here, to make sure that he gets reelected, because he's a fantastic. I watched him working with a woman last night trying to solve her some of her pay issues. I mean, this is a guy that really cares, who stands up for Marylanders on the Eastern Shore and Lower Shore.
I always get a sense that he's just looking a bit over his shoulder as he's seen this sort of Republican wave, and not just in a state legislative sense, but also in a local sense. For instance, Wicomico County is now dominated by Republicans. It didn't used to be. What do you think happened, and how do you turn that around? I mean, I've talked to Democrats here in Wicomico County who admit that there's a weak structure here. It's not there. Or are we to be resigned to the idea that Republicans are going to be basically representing this lower shore?
Democrats on the lower shore get elected because they appeal not only to Democrats, but also to independent voters and also to Republicans. And that's how Jim Mathias has gotten reelected over and over again. It's how Jake Day gets elected. It's how Victoria Jackson Stanley in Cambridge gets elected. It's how Delegate Cherie Sample Hughes gets elected, because they are, all politics is local, and they're focused on those local issues. But we also are building our Democratic infrastructure, and organization is really important. And that's why we're here a year early, working with all of our Democratic Central Committees, the growing number of Democrats who've joined clubs, a lot of the new progressive groups over here, to get everyone working together and really building the muscle of the Democratic Party from the precinct level up. And so over the summer of 2017, across the state of Maryland, we are knocking on doors so that we can have 10,000 conversations with folks, you know, independent voters, true blue Democrats, Democrats who maybe stayed home in the last election, talking to them about the issues that they care about. And this is our way to build the infrastructure of the Democratic Party so that we're ready to continue to have those conversations going into 2018 and really motivate those people to come out and vote. It's so important that people vote. And one of the things that has happened in the last two elections is a lot of Democrats did stay home and they didn't vote. And a lot of Republicans stayed home because they weren't motivated. And we've got to get people out to vote. And I think that's really, for me as a Democrat, the silver lining in the Trump election is that people are more motivated than they ever have been before, because they see that this affects their lives, that these are issues that affect them very personally and affect their families.
Well, so how do you assess the Democratic field? We've had a number of folks that have been entering. The latest day, I think, was the wife of Elijah Cummings, is thinking about doing it. We have Ben Jealous, who was with the NAACP, Rusher Baker, who's also the PG County executive, and so on. Richard Maldaleno also in there. I mean, you got a whole host of things. And how do you see that field in terms of where, say, the establishment party is, if you will, and what is considered the progressive wing, the sort of Bernie Sanders folks? How do you bridge that divide?
Well, let me just say, we are seeing more people running for office and more Democrats running for office than ever before. Last night at the event that we did in Salisbury, we had people running for county council, city council. We had people running for the first district of Maryland in Congress. We're seeing more people running, and we have a huge field on the gubernatorial side. This is good. More people jumping into the arena saying, you know, I want to serve. I want to help my community is a really good thing, and choice is a good thing. On the gubernatorial front, we have two county executives, very capable experience. We have, as you mentioned, Ben Jealous. We have another gentleman from, or two other gentlemen from Baltimore City, Jim Shea, an accomplished lawyer and public servant for many years, serving on the University of Maryland Board of Regents. Alec Ross, who was in Teach for America in Baltimore. His wife is a Baltimore school teacher for 20 years, jumping in after serving in the Obama administration. Maya Rockamore Cummings, who has been a big policy person on a lot of issues about the growing income inequality in our country. Rich Maldaleno, a seasoned state senator. A great field out there, and I think you're going to see in the course of this primary a really strong Democrat emerge from that primary process, because they're going to be focused on one thing. Things aren't working now. It's going to be more a race against how Democrats can deliver kind of better programs, better options, more economic growth than our current governor.
But how do you bridge this what seems to be a divide between the progressive wing of the party and the mainstream of the party? Mike Miller, president of the Senate, was down here the other day, and we were talking about the gubernatorial candidates, and he was backing one of the folks from Baltimore. But when it came to Ben Jealous, he was sort of dismissive. Now, I hope I'm not reading too much into that, but he certainly was not a big fan. And I think, and what it seemed to represent to me in that conversation is that there is this progressive wing that is making all these demands, and it may be just a little uncomfortable. So how do you reach out to those folks? Because as I was reading about your own candidacy, you were described as sort of the establishment candidate for the chairmanship. You got all those folks to back you. You were, you know, as opposed to the progressives who oftentimes find themselves at least feeling like they're outside.
I have to say I bristle a little bit when people call me the establishment candidate, because I actually am an outsider who's come in because I care about my community, I care about my state, and I care about my country. And but I also understand the process. And to get elected, I had to get the support of all of the central committees across the entire state. That's hundreds of people, as well as the elected officials. And so I just did my homework and I did my due diligence, and I ran an election with opposition against a progressive, and I was elected for it. So I think we need to get away from the labels. I think we need to start focusing on what are the solutions that people are putting out there. What are the issues that they're identifying that really resonate with voters? And I think what you're hearing all of these Democrats, regardless of the labels that you put on them, what they're all saying is people are still hurting. People are scared because they're worried that the governance we have now is not making things better. And so they're going to be looking for people that talk about how do you raise wages? How do you make sure that healthcare is even more affordable? How do you make sure our public schools are delivering the children with the capabilities to get the jobs of the future? And how are we creating those jobs of the future? And I think you're going to hear Democrats coming up with policies and plans that actually address those issues. And that's the level at which I think voters are going to be making their decision as they look at all these very capable candidates who come from a variety of experiences. I think the process is going to deliver the person who fills the room and is the right person to go up against Larry Hogan and really show Larry Hogan for the politician that he is.
I want to turn to Congressman Andy Harris. I remember when he ran in 2008, he lost to Frank Cradaville, then came back, and obviously during the Tea Party wave, picked up the seat and has not had to look back since. As I looked at the district, which is now was redrawn by Democrats, the district has something like 223,000 Republicans, 176,000 Democrats, about 88,000 independents. That's a pretty steep hill to climb in order for anyone to beat him. Are we to be relegated to the idea that we are going to have a Republican congressman, say, for instance, Andy Harrison, for as long as we can see, given the fact that the way the district lines were drawn, you wanted one extra seat, that seventh Democratic seat, which you got, but that left the folks on the Eastern Shore with a Republican. What do you say to Democrats who say, what happened? What, you know?
I would ask voters, how is Congressman Andy Harris working for you? How do you feel about all those votes, 60 plus votes that he's cast to repeal the Affordable Care Act? How's that working? We saw 800 people show up at his town hall here on the Lower Shore, mad as hell about sort of his votes and the fact that he's not looking out for their local interests. We've seen Andy Harris try to do attachments to various bills that would hurt the environment over here in Maryland. You know, we're going to take a look at a lot of those issues where Andy Harris has not voted in the best interests of the Delmarva Peninsula and the Lower Shore that he represents, the Eastern Shore that he represents. And we also were seeing people who've never run before who say, I'm going to take on Andy Harris. And they're getting a lot of energy and enthusiasm behind them. signing up volunteers. And I think that the Democratic Party will be there to support them in that door-to-door conversation.
Well, as a matter of fact, Heather Mazur, she was, of course, the former candidate for governor in the Democratic primary last time out. She said that the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee is still very old school and won't post cash for races with numbers like the first district show on paper. Do you think that's true? Is the Democratic Party going to invest money into this seat, or are they going to look at the numbers that I just said and said, we'd love to help you out, but we got some other tight races?
I think you'll see a rural strategy in the 2018 race, up and down the ballot from the Maryland Democratic Party. And this, again, is what we've learned from the elections of 2014 and 16, and also our listening tour across the state. It's what we're hearing from our Democrats, that you can't just focus on Baltimore City, Baltimore County, Montgomery County, Prince George's County. You've got to be on all parts of the state, Western Maryland, Eastern Shore, Southern Maryland. And we'll be, we're already investing time and energy. We're over here on the Delmarva Peninsula this week to kick off our efforts, working with Democratic clubs and Democratic Central Committees, and we're going to be here through November of 2018.
So I got to have to ask you, so what do you make of the Trump administration and all of the stuff that's going on? We have the Affordable Care Act, which still seems at least alive for the moment. Then we have the whole Russian affair, which I'm sure Chris has talked a great deal about. What's going on? What's your sense about this? Because I sit every day and feel like I'm stunned. And I know a lot of Republican folks who feel the same way.
I personally was a big supporter of Hillary Clinton. I thought that she was so well prepared to hit the ground on day one and actually truly make America great again. And I was extremely disappointed that people put their faith in Donald Trump. But I see, fortunately, that people are losing faith in Donald Trump because of the distractions that he can't seem to avoid. He can't resist tweeting. This is a president of the United States that is spending time watching television shows and then tweeting about them, as opposed to looking at what we need to be doing to really build our economy, which is what he got elected on, which is what he ran on. And we're looking now at the projections for the budget and the deficit going on. We're going to have crises on the financial level that our Secretary of Treasury that is not capable of addressing. And so across the board, we're seeing this economic downward spiral, I think, beginning, and we're only 6 months into this Trump administration. And I think that's what happens when you elect somebody who's an amateur, who talked a good game, but really didn't have a plan or the capabilities to work with Congress to get things done.
Do you think that
this hurts me as an American. This disappoints me because I don't want America to be in that downward spiral. I want to see America getting better. I worry about my children and my grandchildren and whether they'll be able to do as well as their parents. And this is what every American worries about right now.
Do you think there's something that's been fundamentally broken in terms of American politics?
I do think we see a polarization, but you also see a lot of people who know how to work across the aisle and work with the other side. I think here locally, Senator Jim Mathias is a great example of that. I think Mayor Jake Day is a good example of that. I think you see people who really focus on the outcomes and really focus on the best interests of the people they represent. And that's why I ran for Congress, because I believed I could bring those capabilities. It's what I look for in the people that I vote for and elect, and I think it's what I see in Democrats who are going to be running in 2018, and that's what makes me optimistic.
So probably the most important question, tell me something I don't know. what don't we know about Maryland politics?
I think that what people don't realize is how much Maryland is a microcosm of our entire country. When I visit parts of the state, I see, and I've been fortunate as a young child growing up in California to go on long camping trips all over the West with my family to Mount Rushmore and the Grand Tetons and Yellowstone and Yosemite and the Grand Canyon. I've been fortunate being here for my entire adult life to see all parts of our country on the East Coast. I've been to every part of Maryland. My husband and I did one of our first dates to Crisfield, Maryland, as a television news anchor for WJLA, which I was on the air with WJLA for 25 years. We would always kick off Memorial Day with our broadcast from the boardwalk in Ocean City, Maryland. I've done stories on the poultry farms and, you know, been in your universities here, University of Maryland, Salisbury, University of Maryland, Eastern Shore, you know, interviewed some of your professors here. I've seen this state. And this state is very much like America. It's got the rural areas. It's got the beautiful mountains. It's got the beautiful shore. It's got agricultural farming. It's got high-tech innovation in healthcare, in all kinds of things. And it also has, I think, this incredible asset, which is our federal government and the National Institutes of Health that are coming up with immunotherapy now that is going to solve cancer and cures for Alzheimer's. It's got the FDA where those new drugs of the future are being incubated. And this is what we have to protect. This is what we have to represent. All of those interests, rural Maryland, you know, shore Maryland, Southern Maryland, we've got to protect all of this incredible government infrastructure that we have here in Maryland that we're so lucky to have, and realize that in many ways, if we can fix it in Maryland and do better in Maryland, that is a model for the country.
We've been speaking with Kathleen Matthews, the new Democratic chair of the Maryland Democratic Party. Also, by the way, the Chris we're talking about, of course, is Chris Matthews, MSNBC, longtime show running. How long has this show been running, do you know?
My husband's TV show, Hardball, has been on the air for 20 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very lucky to be married to somebody who cares so much about our country. Every night he goes on the air and he just advocates for what he thinks is going to make our country great again. And, you know, he's got a lot of energy around this. He cares a lot about it. He understands history. And while he doesn't get involved in Democratic politics, this is something I do on my own. You know, he's helped me raise three wonderful kids, all who care very much about our country and are involved. And, you know, it's a great marriage. We celebrated our 37th anniversary.
Congratulations.
In June. Yeah.
Well, thanks for
and
stopping
can't
by.
Be involved in politics, but
that's
I'll
right.
Come back to the Delmarva Peninsula.
Well, if
for
you ever
vacation, because
well,
we've spent a lot of nice holiday weekends here.
If he wants to stop by, we're willing to interview him.
Great. Thank you so much.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening. The Senate health care bill is dead. Or is it? Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. With the loss of two more Republican senators, Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced this week that the upper chamber will not be taking up the legislation at all. And the Kentucky Republican offered a measure to repeal but delay. That has died with moderate Republicans deserting GOP ranks. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump finally suggested just to let the Affordable Care Act fail. In our studio this morning is Vincent DeMarco. He's with Healthcare for All, which is holding a number of hearings, public forums on Medicaid in Maryland this week. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me. A pleasure to be here in Salisbury.
So what is your reaction then to the latest news out of the Capitol Hill?
We're very pleased that the anti-healthcare bill, which Senator Mitch McConnell and President Trump were proposing, is dead, has failed. Because that means that the health care that 22 million Americans rely on from the Affordable Care Act is not under threat anymore like it had been. And we commend those senators who rejected it because it was going to take away health care. In particular, three senators who said no way were they going to go along with the repeal-only bill that President Trump was proposing now. Senator Collins from Maine, Senator Murkowski, Lisa Murkowski from Alaska and Senator Capito from West Virginia, three women Republicans said no way would they accept a bill that was going to immediately end the Medicaid program, which has helped so many millions of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Marylanders. And that's why we were in Salisbury with a forum where people who benefited from the Medicaid program told their story. And these stories are very powerful, Don. These stories are life and death stories. You may have seen the front page of the Salisbury Daily Times where this woman said she's scared to death that her health care was going to be taken away. That was before we learned that that bill was dead. Now, we're not letting down our guard. We know that the congressional Republican leadership wants to do this. We don't know why, but they want to take health care away from 22 million Americans, hundreds of thousands of Marylanders. Sadly, Representative Andrew Harris, who represents this district, voted for this immoral piece of legislation. I don't know how he sleeps at night, knowing that he voted to take thousands of his constituents off of health care, maybe threatening their lives, including Joanna Weaver, who's disabled, and who tells how reliant she is on Medicaid to be able to work, to be able to live. She's the one who said she was scared to death that the bill that Andy Harris voted for would become law. Why does that have to happen? It doesn't have to happen. One of the things we want people to understand is it's not only these millions of Americans and hundreds of thousands of Marylanders who benefit from Medicaid directly who are helped, but all of us. Since the Affordable Care Act took effect, there's been a dramatic decrease in uncompensated hospital care, which is people not having health care coverage going to the hospital to be treated for emergencies and for acute problems. Who pays for that? All of us, through higher premiums. We call that a hidden health care tax. So the Medicaid expansion has helped reduce the hidden health care tax on all of us. It's a huge success. We hope that Congress will not ever take up again a repeal. And we want to commend our two senators, Ben Cardin and Chris Van Hollen, and the rest of our congressional delegation for standing up to this and sticking with the Affordable Care Act.
Let me ask you this. What do you think went wrong for the Republicans? Are we talking before this interview that they ran against the Affordable Care Act in 2010? Here we are some seven odd years later, and they ran into this problem of then what to do with replacing the Affordable Care Act. What do you think structurally went wrong? Was it just simply that they wanted to simply eliminate it, or they were rolling back? Because there are certainly forces within the Republican Party to do that. Or was there any real effort to find any kind of real alternative?
They never really had a serious alternative. That's their fundamental problem. All the times when President Obama was president that they passed repeal measures, they knew it wasn't really going to take effect because President Obama would veto it. In fact, Senator Pat Toomey, a Republican from Pennsylvania, was quoted recently as saying they never thought Donald Trump was going to win. And they thought they didn't have to come up with anything because they would pass a repeal. Clinton would veto it, so they wouldn't have to worry. But when Trump became president, it suddenly became real. In other words, if they passed these measures, millions of people would lose their health care. And they heard about it. They heard about it in amazing, loud ways from Americans all across the country. Support for what we can call Trump care or Ryan care or McConnell care was at the most 17%. Some polls showed it as 8%, because the American people did not want this kind of disaster. And in fact, support for the Affordable Care Act is at an all-time high amongst Americans all across the country, because Americans know the Affordable Care Act is working. Now, it needs to be tweaked. It needs to be fixed. And we knew that all the time. That's why several Republican senators, most prominently Senator Susan Collins from Maine, has said, okay, let's stop trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Let's work with the Democrats to come up with some fixes. We hope they do that. And I know that Senator Chris Van Hollen and Senator Ben Cardin and the rest of our delegation, aside maybe from Andrew Harris, want to do that. In fact, Senator Ben Cardin has proposed a measure, Senate Bill 1511, which would make some really good suggested changes to the Affordable Care Act. So we hope that that's what happens next. Sensible legislation. We were very pleased that Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican from Tennessee, chairs the Health Committee, publicly announced he's going to hold a hearing. Thank goodness, a hearing where people can say, this is what's going on well. This is what needs to be fixed. I hope he follows through and holds that hearing, because we'll learn a lot then about what we could do to make the Affordable Care Act better. We're all in favor of that. Meanwhile, I want to emphasize that we in Maryland are not just sitting around waiting. We're doing these events across the state, one in Baltimore City, one in Salisbury, and we're going to have them all across the state showing how Medicaid benefits people. In addition, the Maryland General Assembly enacted a new law creating a health insurance coverage protection commission. I'm honored to be on that commission. The chairs are Senator Brian Feldman from Montgomery County, Delegate Jocelyn Pena Melnick from Prince George's County. This commission, with representatives picked by the legislature and the governor, are charged with examining what happens in Congress and out of the Trump administration and see how we can fix whatever problems they cause in Maryland. Because we're worried that the Trump administration, now that they can't get this repeal bill, will try to administratively undermine the ACA.
Well, I was going to ask you, because the words out of the president and many of the congressional members, but particularly, is that the Affordable Care Act is going to fail. The president says we should just not do anything and let it fail. What do you say to them? They talk about high skyrocketing premiums, for example, as one example, or health insurance in a number of counties. That's one of the other arguments that's been made. And they look at the landscape. They say this is imploding, and maybe it's the best thing to do is just simply stand back and watch it implode.
That is a disgraceful and immoral attitude for President Trump, and it's shameful for him to say that he's not going to try to help people keep the health insurance they have. He's in a position to help them. He doesn't want to do it. That is shameful. But let me just say, it's important to remember that there are two key parts of the Affordable Care Act. One is the expansion of Medicaid. And luckily, there's nothing that President Trump can do to undermine that. That's in place. It's working. They were trying to repeal it with the Affordable Care Act repeal bills they had. Luckily, that's gone. And that's millions of Americans, hundreds of thousands of Marylanders, including many thousands right here on the Lower Shore, who are benefiting from the Medicaid. They're not going to be able to undermine that too easily. The private insurance under the Affordable Care Act does depend on some government actions, including keeping the subsidies in place and making sure they enforce the requirement that everybody get health care so that there's a pool of insurance to keep premiums low. So there have to be some actions. And one of the things we're hoping Congress will do is to shore up those things so the Trump administration can't undermine it. If President Trump and his administration try to do things that would undermine the Affordable Care Act and violate the law, luckily, Attorney General Brian Frosch now has the authority to sue them to stop them from doing it. Our commission's going to look carefully. So they better watch out, because if they try to do something like they tried on the travel ban where Attorney General Frosch went to court, if they try to do something which flagrantly violates the Affordable Care Act, we're going to urge Attorney General Frosch to sue them. If they do other things which don't violate the law but still undermine the act, we may have to take some actions in Maryland to protect the Affordable Care Act private insurance. But one of the things I want to emphasize, one of the reasons premiums have been going up is the fear of insurance companies that these repeals were going to pass, because that would have undermined the Affordable Care Act, and they were trying to protect themselves. Hopefully now the failure of McConnell Care and Ryan Care and Trump Care will encourage the insurers that the Affordable Care Act is there to stay, and they can stabilize those premiums. But we want to work with Senator Cardin, Senator Van Hollen, and the rest of our delegation in Congress to make sure the Affordable Care Act is as strong as possible.
What about this idea that the administration might just simply withhold subsidies?
Well,
is that legal? I mean,
they can't do that without Congress.
Okay.
Because the subsidies are in law. Now, if they propose a budget that doesn't have the subsidies, Congress can put them back in. And I'm pretty confident they will, because enough Democrats and Republicans aren't going to say you can't have those subsidies that would, they know, throw people off health care. I just don't think that's going to happen. And one of the things that Americans need to understand is that those of you out there in Maryland and across the country who are demanding that the Affordable Care Act not be repealed, we've got some success, but don't let your guard down. Keep up the pressure to keep the Affordable Care Act going.
One of the things that struck me about this debate is that one of the issues that came up, particularly in the Senate, was that they can only repeal so much. They can't, because of the reconciliation issues. One of the things they didn't, as I recall, could not repeal was covering pre-existing conditions, which seems to be the underlie everything else. If you have to cover somebody, whether they have a pre-existing condition or not, everything else then flows from that. As I say, you have to have mechanisms then to cover those people. So that seemed to me as if you would eliminate everything else but that, you've got a real serious problem. You have to find some other alternative to funding it. I mean, is that sort of the linchpin here?
Well, again, remember there are two parts of the of the program.
Right,
the Medicaid is not affected.
That's
by
separate.
It. Medicaid,
yeah, right.
Everybody on their Medicaid has all the full coverage. In the private insurance, it was very, very important that that piece be put in saying you can't deny someone for pre-existing conditions. But, and again, I want to emphasize that in coming up with that, the Obama administration and the Democratic Congress held hearings, talked to insurance executives, talked to consumers, talked with hospitals, talked with doctors to come up with a plan that worked. McConnell and Ryan and Trump didn't talk with anybody, and they came up with a disastrous plan. You can't have a system where insurance companies are required to give everybody care, even if they have pre-existing condition, without at the same time requiring that everybody get insurance, because if you do, someone will only buy insurance when they're sick. And that would cause premiums to go way up and make it impossible to have health insurance. When you say insurance companies, you can't deny somebody they have a pre-existing condition, you also have to say everybody needs to chip in and be part of the system. That's the only way it works.
It seemed to me, well, I mean, the answer in terms of chipping in was this idea that you would have, for instance, people who are young who may perhaps even get in health insurance, and they pay this penalty, and you're sort of encouraging them, as opposed to just simply taxing everybody, right? Which is a separate thing,
right?
Well, I mean, was that a very efficient way to get everybody to pool in?
It's the most effective way. It's worked in Massachusetts for years under former Governor Romney. They enacted this law that has this personal responsibility and this requirement that insurance companies cover everybody. It's worked. Everybody does it. Almost everybody does pay the penalty, but most people do it. Only 3% uninsured in Massachusetts. It really works. The fact of the matter is, most people, when a choice is between paying some amount into their taxes and not getting anything, or paying some amount into insurance and getting insurance, will do the latter. But again, unless these folks who are not sick are encouraged to get insurance, you can't require insurance companies to insure everybody, or else they won't be able to afford it. It just will not work.
So do you see this debate as moving the idea of single-payer system forward? People have now begun to talk a little more about that, even though I personally see that as a long way away, given we have all this infrastructure for the current system.
We need to focus on making the Affordable Care Act work. And there's a lot to do there. And I know that at the state level, a single-payer would not work. The state of Vermont tried it, studied it. And a progressive governor there decided it just can't be done at the state level. So let's not have that distracting discussion. Let's focus on making the Affordable Care Act effective. And one of the things that we have to put a lot of attention on, whatever kind of coverage system you have, is the underlying causes of increased cost. And one of those is high prescription drug prices. That is something we need to deal with. And in Maryland this year, we passed the first law in the country prohibiting price gouging by off-patent and generic drug manufacturers. Our wonderful Attorney General Brian Frosch now has the authority to go to court and stop this from happening. And he's going to take advantage of that. And we thank virtually the whole Maryland General Assembly for voting for that. And the governor decided not to sign it, not to veto it. But unfortunately, he wrote a letter which has provided ammunition to the drug corporations who are suing to stop the effective date of that law.
The letter said what?
The letter said the law is unconstitutional, too vague, but I still don't want to sign it or veto it. It's unfortunate that he wrote that letter because that's ammunition the drug corporations are using to go to court. Now, I just want to say also, Governor Hogan did something really good yesterday. He joined 10 other governors from across the country in saying that Congress should not repeal the ACA. So we thank him for that. But we are kind of concerned that he wrote this letter giving ammunition to the drug corporations. We're confident that Attorney General Frosch will prevail in court and defend that law. So we're going to enforce that law. And we actually have a website your listeners should think about. Healthcareforall.com/hearmystory. Healthcareforall.com/hearmystory. That's where people can write on there in English or Spanish if they've been subjected to skyrocketing prescription drug prices. Tell us your story, and we'll pass them on to the Attorney General if they could be the basis of a lawsuit, or they'll help us build a case for additional legislation. We want to go back in 2018 with more legislation to do something about skyrocketing prescription drug prices.
How do you rate Governor Hogan in terms of this battle over health care? As you mentioned a moment ago, he's certainly has distanced himself, it seems, from the repeal effort, even though he, in his own words, certainly has said that he believes that the Affordable Care Act is failing. That's certainly his view, but he wasn't crazy about the Senate or the House version, for that matter. How do you see him handling this issue at the state level in terms of legislation, in terms of just approach to dealing with the health care here?
Well, it's an excellent question, and first of all, again, thank him for writing that letter. There are other governors who have done more, like John Kasich of Ohio, and we hope that he'll do as much as they are in opposing these bad measures in Congress. Here in Maryland, we are disappointed that he wrote that letter on a prescription drug law, and we hope that in the future he'll work more closely with us to do something about prescription drug prices. We want to work with the administration to make the Affordable Care Act work. And there's an excellent man named Dr. Howard Haft, who's now running the Health Benefit Exchange. And we know that he's interested in making it work. So we want to work with them to do that. And right now, this commission I mentioned, I think, is the most important vehicle going forward to figure out how to make healthcare work in Maryland. And that commission is comprised of people picked by the legislature and by the governor. Again, I'm honored to be on it. And we're going to be looking very closely at all these issues. The first hearing is on August 1 at 1 o'clock in Annapolis. So members of the public are welcome to come and hear what's going on.
So one of the basic issues, it seemed to me, is that the Affordable Care Act was essentially an insurance reform act, that it wasn't really designed in principle to deal with the rising health costs in terms of whether it's the cost of a hospital or cost of drugs, for example, or just visits. And these are all fee-for-service transactions. What do you think needs to be done in order to reform the health care system to get those costs down? What kind of countervailing force can you see applying that downward force? Because in a lot of other countries, for example, it's the government that pushes down right. All these prices.
Yeah. Well, first of all, the Affordable Care Act does contain significant provisions to encourage preventive care, like making no copays for preventive care, encouraging things that keep people healthy. And there's comparative effectiveness studies in there to make sure that money goes to places and procedures that work. So it does have provisions in it to improve public health and reduce healthcare, skyrocketing healthcare costs. It was unfortunate that there was nothing in there on prescription drugs. That was out of it. One of the things that should be done at the federal level that Representative Elijah Cummings has been pushing for is to simply allow the Medicare agency to negotiate with the prescription drug companies. It's really shameful that they can't. The VA does and gets good prices. Why can't Medicare? That would help a lot to reduce prescription drug prices. That's one area that the Affordable Care Act has not dealt with, which needs to be. So that's why we're trying to deal with that at the state level. Another very important thing that's happened here in Maryland is our all-payer hospital system, which is now incentivizes hospitals to keep people healthy rather than paying them every time somebody comes into the hospital. So we're working on implementing that better. And we at the Citizens Health Initiative are working on a program called the Maryland Faith Health Network, where we're bringing congregations and hospitals together to give people support before and after they go to hospital to keep people healthy. We need to do more things like that. So the Affordable Care Act is a good base, but at the state level, we need to do a lot more.
Do you think that ultimately a public option is something that's going to be needed?
It's an idea we should definitely consider. We should definitely consider at the federal and state level. It's going to be virtually impossible to pass that in Congress. It couldn't even be passed under a Democratic Congress when they passed the Affordable Care Act. Can it be done in Maryland? We're going to look at that with this commission.
So what do you see in terms of going forward, the prospects for health reform? And obviously, the folks who are supportive of the Affordable Care Act, certainly saw this as a victory.
Yes.
But as I indicated before, the question is it really dead, or is it some form of it really dead? Is it the political will for to push forward? Do you think that Obamacare is so now rooted in the system that they're going to have to figure out a way to make it work?
Well, you know, Senator Van Hollen sent out a message to everybody saying, don't let down your guard.
Right.
And that's absolutely true. And people on Eastern Shore should specifically let Representative Andy Harris know that his vote was a bad one. He should never do that again, vote to throw so many people off their health care. But I think it's going to be very difficult for the Republican leadership in the Senate to pass a bill that both the right wing, like Senator Ted Cruz, and the more moderates, like Senator Susan Collins, both want to vote for without any Democratic support. I just don't think that's possible. What that means is it's time for Senator Alexander from Tennessee to hold a hearing and for reasonable people on the Democratic and Republican side to come together and figure out how to make the Affordable Care Act better. I don't think it's possible for them to pass a repeal of the Affordable Care Act. I just don't think it's possible. And that means they need to work together in the Congress to come up with measures that make sense.
So, I mean, is it then that the Affordable Care Act or a lot of the major features, pre-existing conditions as an example, or even the expansion of Medicaid and so on, are those so deeply then rooted into the system that we are going to be living with that legacy forever? Because one of the things, I remember in 2012 talking with some Republicans right after their convention, and my observation was that when you get a program like this with its teeth into the ground, it's hard to then pull them back out. Or as they like to say in the Middle East, there are facts on the ground. You can't get rid of them.
Yes, that's exactly the right way to put it. When there are 22 to 30 million Americans, hundreds of thousands of Marylanders, whose health care depends on the Affordable Care Act, taking that away from them, I believe, as the Republican leadership found out, becomes near impossible. And that's good for all of us.
So any final thoughts for the folks who are perhaps scared that despite this victory?
You can rest more easy tonight. And frankly, Don, there are millions of Americans who've been scared to death since November 8th of last year that their health care was going to be taken away. Tonight, they can sleep more easily. They shouldn't rest, should continue to let their members of Congress know they want the Affordable Care Act in place. We can all rest more easy. And go to healthcareforall.com. You can see what we're doing. And again, I want to get people to go to healthcareforall.com/hearmystory. If you've been subjected to prescription drug price increases that hurt you, because we want to know about that. We want to work together to make sure the Affordable Care Act stays in place and that we build on it to achieve our goal of quality, affordable health care for all Marylanders.
Do you think that this will then weigh into the election next year?
It should. It should in Maryland and it should everywhere. People like Andy Harris, who voted to throw so many people off their health care, need to be reminded of that. And he needs to have to defend having had that vote. That needs to be all across the country. And we're a completely nonpartisan organization, and we are very pleased that Republican Senators Susan Collins and others did what they did to stop the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Democrats and Republicans everywhere need to be running on building the Affordable Care Act and not destroying it.
We've been speaking with Vincent DeMarco. He's with Health Care for All. And, of course, on this week in which a major defeat, certainly for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, but we will see what the next chapter holds. So appreciate you stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.